It had been the most exhilarating, exciting, and exhausting day of Elijah's life. Electricity was in the air when all Israel and the prophets of Baal gathered to Mount Carmel at the command of Elijah sent forth to Israel through Ahab the king. And with power and urgency, he preached to them on the subject summarized in the question, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions?" And then with irresistible logic, he had suggested the test of strength between Jehovah and Baal. And for a good part of the day, until the middle of the afternoon probably, he had with assembled Israel watched the increasingly fanatic worship and wild dancing of the pagan prophets. He had mocked them when their God had not heard them. He said, "He's on a journey. Is he perhaps asleep?" He said even other things to them. And so the distraction and inattentiveness of their God to their cries had become the subject of ridicule. And when the pagan prophets were exhausted then by mid-afternoon, Elijah called the people to him and prepared with his own hands the ox. You imagine the bloody and heavy work that was, the long minutes, perhaps as much as an hour, of heavy manual labor. And then after directing the altar he had built to be doused with water three times, Elijah lifted up his whole soul in prayer to God that he would vindicate himself. And the fire, in breathtaking and thrilling fashion, had fallen and consumed the sacrifice, consumed the stones, consumed the water, consumed the dust around the altar. And immediately following this, Elijah had led Israel in the slaughter of the prophets of Baal, the 450 prophets of Baal, by the river that ran along the bottom of Mount Carmel. And when this bloody and nerve-wracking work was done, Elijah had once again given himself to prayer that God would bring an end of the drought that had led Israel to this place and had devastated her economically and killed her people. And then, finally, he had seen the cloud the size of a man's hand on the western horizon. And as he went to tell the king that the rain was coming, he then followed the king and ran before him like a herald, the 12 to 14 miles to Jezreel. And at the end of this very long day, with his servant in his accommodations, whatever they were at Jezreel, there had come the knock on the door and the messenger of Jezebel saying that she would have the gods do to her and even more if she said, "I do not make your life as one of them by tomorrow about this time." It's this long day of physical and emotional work, and as a result, exhaustion, that's the backdrop to our text, 1 Kings 19, verses 3 and 4. "And he was afraid, and arose and ran for his life, and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree, and he requested for himself that he might die and said, 'It is enough now, O Lord, take my life, for I am not better than my fathers.'" You might give many titles to this text, but I want to call it Elijah's Death Wish. And I have four things I want you to notice about it. First of all, I want you to notice the reality of Elijah's death wish. The reality of Elijah's death wish. I have three things that I want to say, and I want you to understand about the fact or reality of Elijah's death wish. The first thing I want you to understand is that this death wish of Elijah embodied a desire to leave a world which for him by then was a world full of fear, disappointment, discouragement, suffering, grief, and hurt. Notice how the prayer, what he says in the prayer. He says, "It's enough. It's enough. I'm through," he says. "I've had enough, Lord, enough fear. I've had enough disappointment. I've had enough work. I'm tired. I'm weary. I can't bear this burden anymore. I've had enough. I've had enough of all these things." And so this prayer embodied a desire to leave a world full of sorrow. But second, this death wish of Elijah, we notice, was a prayer to God. It was a prayer. He wanted to have God let him leave. "Get me out of here, God. I just want to die." He wanted God to let him go from the world he lived in, the world as it looked to him at that time. He was asking God to get him out of there. But that brings me to the third place to say, since this death wish was a prayer, that this death wish of Elijah was not, therefore, a threat to commit suicide. Nor did it embody a desire to commit suicide. It's wrong to take our own lives. It's God's sovereign prerogative to take life when he chooses. But it is not suicidal, if I can put it that way, to ask God to take our lives if he wills. A desire to die is not identical to a desire to commit suicide. Now, of course, a desire to die is serious. A desire to die may be sinful, but it's not necessarily, you see, suicidal, especially when it's expressed in the form of a prayer that God would take our lives. Of course, we should take it seriously if we see in others or feel in ourselves a desire to die. Suicide, however, is an act of rebellion against the God of life. Praying to die, whatever else it might embody, involve, or include, or presuppose, is at least an act of submission to the God of life and death. Now, before we move on, I want to just apply this briefly to us all. We have here, first of all, believe it or not, in a text like this, believe it or not, we have here something to encourage us. Yes, we do. We have something to encourage us here in Elijah's death wish. And it's this. Clearly, even good people may sometimes get so dreary, dark, and discouraged that they pray to die and want to die. Elijah was a good man. Elijah was a godly man. Elijah was certainly a strong man. And Elijah wanted to die. Satan may come to us in our dark moments when we feel like Elijah. And he may say, if you were good, if you were godly, if you were a Christian, if you weren't such a wimp, you wouldn't feel like this. He may whisper in our ear that if we were godly, we would not even have such a desire. He may accuse us of being suicidal because we have a desire to die. He may say that we're not even Christians if we feel like this. But believer, we must not listen to him. Elijah prayed to die. And if Elijah, the good, godly, strong man Elijah, could pray to die, so can other Christians in their worst days come to feel the same. And we should not adopt the counsel of despair against ourselves because we happen to feel like Elijah felt on some days. There's something else here, something to instruct us. Some of you, I don't know, may have a hard time entering into what Elijah is feeling here. You never in your life have felt the least inclination to pray that God would take your life. You've never felt this way at all. You believe what the Bible says. You believe that Elijah was good and godly, but for yourself personally, a desire to die, a desire to leave the world, a desire to have it all over with, this desire expressed by Elijah here, not something you can really enter into. You've never felt this way. We do well to remember, if especially we've not had deep experience of this kind of darkness of soul, that the people around us are weak human beings. Elijah, the man of God, looked strong, was strong, and he wanted to die. You see, I think we're prone to forget or to be unaware of what fragile vessels of clay those people around us are. Maybe if we remembered how dark this world can be sometimes, we would deal more gently, more wisely, more carefully with other human beings. We look at someone, they seem strong, impervious to suffering. We get out our cricket bat and hit them right in the forehead with our opinions, with our criticisms, with our exhortations, with our admonitions. And they seem to take it pretty well. But what you don't know is this. Because of your harshness, because of the fact that you didn't come with the right spirit of prayer and gentleness, that dear person goes away because of your opinions and criticisms, feeling and wanting to die. If we only remembered how weak people are, how we might want to be dealt with if we were them, we would perhaps deal with them differently. There's something here to teach us. A spirit of gentleness, the same spirit of gentleness that I think the Apostle Paul exhorts us to have when we deal with others who are in need of encouragement, exhortation, or admonition. Well, that's the reality of Elijah's death wish. I want you to think in the second place of the roots of Elijah's death wish. The roots of it. What is it that can make a strong man like Elijah, a godly man like Elijah, come to the place where he literally prays to die and asks God to take his life? Well, I think an examination of the text and its context shows that there are at least four roots. I think what I want to call them are occasions, because they're not excuses for what Elijah did, but there are four occasions of Elijah's death wish, though not excuses. The first occasion of Elijah's death wish I've already asked you to reflect on with me. It's his exhaustion. I think we must begin by understanding that there was an undeniable connection between Elijah's physical and emotional condition and the reaction at the end of that long day that left him praying to die. I began this message by describing to you the years worth of work and emotion that he'd packed into that one long day on Mount Carmel. It was at the end of that day that Elijah received Jezebel's death threat and then reacted so badly. You do not need to excuse Elijah's reaction if you recognize the physical and emotional exhaustion which had something to do with his running from Jezreel and with his prayer under the juniper tree to die. So the first occasion was his exhaustion. The second was disappointment. Disappointment. Disappointment was a tremendous factor in Elijah's prayer to die. In a strange way, you know, Elijah's disappointment says something very good about him. You know, there's an old saying that says that if you aim at nothing, you'll always hit it. Well, that's true. The only person who may miss his target is the person who is actually aiming at something. You can't be disappointed unless you have high ideals for which you are living, unless you're aiming at something. Unless you're trying to do something, you can never be disappointed. Elijah's disappointment at least says he was trying to accomplish something for the Lord. Now, Elijah was disappointed, I think, with several things or several people. Elijah was clearly disappointed in the first place with himself. He was disappointed with himself. How clearly he says this in his prayer to die. He says, you remember there, Lord, take my life for what? I am not better than my fathers. What's embodied in that? He thought he had been, and now he knows he's not, and he's disappointed with himself. Elijah had an ideal for himself. He was going to raise Israel up out of the degradation, out of the apostasy in which he'd found it. He was going to do something that his fathers had not done, that his fathers had failed to do. And now, at the end of the day in which he thought that great goal was going to be accomplished, he runs in fear from the woman Jezebel. No, indeed, he feels now he is not better than his fathers, and he is really, really disappointed with himself. Even at the end of that great day on Mount Carmel, he said to himself, what have I accomplished? And no wonder that I've accomplished nothing. Look how in carnal fear I've run from that wicked woman Jezebel. How could he expect? How can I expect, he must have said to himself, God to bless and use me when I can do something like this? Elijah was deeply disappointed with himself. No wonder he wanted to die. But Elijah was also disappointed with the people of God. He was disappointed with the people of God. Now, this may seem strange. In some ways it is strange. Isn't this the very day in which the people of God had seen God vindicate himself in flaming fire on Mount Carmel and had said in Elijah's presence, Jehovah, he's God. Jehovah, he is God. Why are you so disappointed with the people of God, Elijah? Well, it's easy for us, in spite of what people say, knowing the fickleness of the human heart, to entertain cynical doubts about the real commitments of those who had cried out so enthusiastically. He was deeply disappointed in the people of God, their sins burdened, oppressed, and discouraged him. Both in verse 10 and again in verse 14, he complains about the sins of the sons of Israel to Jehovah. Look at verse 10. He said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left. You see how discouraged he is with the people of God? Disappointed with them? Elijah saw it all too clearly. The altars, the apostasy, the golden calves, the Baal worship. And yes, of course, they had said after they saw the fire, Jehovah, he's God, but how long will it last, he thinks. Discouraging sight to see the apostasy of Israel, the shortcomings of God's people. But not only was he disappointed with himself and disappointed with the people of God, he was disappointed with God himself. This seems to be reflected in his words, I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, with the implication left hanging in the air, and where has it gotten me? Why has he not blessed me and encouraged me in my zeal? Why did he let Jezebel do that? Send that death threat? I was exhausted. I couldn't stand it at the time. I thought something had been accomplished. And at the end of this great day, then Elijah says, I received the death threat of Jezebel. Why did you let that happen, God? The Christian life is a trial of our faith in the goodness of God. Perhaps every Christian, at some time of his life, at some situation or other, feels like saying to God, God, why did you let that happen? I can't believe you let that happen, Lord. And Elijah felt that way that day. As he prayed under the juniper tree to die, Elijah felt disappointment with God. Elijah said, I can't believe this has happened. So he was disappointed with God. He said, if you're not going to bless me, if the rest of my life is going to be the same kind of misery that I'm experiencing right now, if you're really merciful, God, just kill me, please. Well, you see, Elijah was a man of high ideals for himself, for the people of God. High expectations, faith in God. And as he prayed under that juniper tree, he wept with a sense of disappointment in himself, in the people of God, and in God himself. And I think if we will examine our own hearts when we are discouraged, we will see that it's the same kind of things that make us discouraged. And sometimes in the secret of our hearts, in the secret of our hearts, make us want to die. I've been a Christian so many years, and I'm not what I should be. It even seems that I've slid back from where I was. And God's people are not what I think they should be as well. I've been hurt by God's people. I am burdened by their sins. The church is not what I hoped it would be. It's not what I thought it was, and now I see it's not. God's people, perhaps, have deeply disappointed you, and God himself. You thought you knew that God was good. You thought you knew what God would do and what God wouldn't do. And God has let things happen in your life that you simply can't believe he would allow. And yet, there they are. Why did you let that happen, God? Well, I'm not saying, of course, that Elijah's disappointment is justified, or that your disappointment, especially in God, is justified. Elijah had forgotten significant facts. Elijah was not looking at life through the lens of faith. All I'm saying, though, is one major cause for Elijah's death wish was the disappointment of his ideals. But there is a third, exhaustion, disappointment, a third occasion for his death wish, and it is loneliness. Twice he says it. Do you hear it? I alone am left. You hear it? Here is loneliness in that. Another cause of prayers to die is loneliness. Whatever other conclusions we draw from the statement of Elijah, I alone am left, we must draw the conclusion that he felt alone. And the Bible itself, God himself says, it's not good for a man to be alone. Thoughts and worries allowed to stagnate in the swamps of our own minds with no deep friend with which to share them, no place to air them out publicly in the clear light of day with someone we trust, no one to share them with and talk them over with. thoughts like that, worries like that, bad times like that are like stagnant water that breeds all sorts of foul creatures. And so loneliness is another cause, occasion at least, of Elijah's death wish, exhaustion, disappointment, loneliness, and of course fear. That's what the text says explicitly, doesn't it? And he was afraid. The fourth impetus of Elijah's desire to die was carnal fear. Faith took flight late that night in Jezreel, and fear took over. The threat of Jezebel bred in Elijah's weary mind the image of himself. He'd seen 450 dead prophets that day, you remember? And Elijah's and Jezebel's death threat painted his own face on one of those dead prophets of Baal. The image was dreadful when he imagined it. Now, this is kind of strange though, isn't it? He flees from Jezebel. Why? He's afraid to die. When he gets to the juniper tree, he prays that God will kill him. Well, you know, cold logic would say, Elijah, if you were afraid to die, why are you praying now that God will kill you? Does this make any sense whatsoever, Elijah? Well, of course it doesn't. But when we get discouraged like this, we don't make any sense, do we? We need a friend to come by and sit by us and say, you're not making any sense. You're afraid. Is there any good reason for you're afraid to die, and so you're praying to die? What's up with that? Well, but when we are discouraged and disappointed and exhausted and lonely and afraid like Elijah, so afraid that we want to die, such cold logic doesn't occur to us, does it? It didn't occur to Elijah. He simply had fled in dread of Jezebel's assassins. Well, those are the roots of Elijah's death wish. Remember them? Exhaustion, disappointment, loneliness, fear. But now I want to come in the third place to think of the remedies. The remedies for Elijah's death wish. Because the rest of 1 Kings 19 is actually God, the great physician, the physician of souls, ministering to, as a physician, his needy, spiritually sick servant. And I want you to see some of the things God does in this chapter, because I think we can learn for ourselves how to minister to other people on the basis of what God does for Elijah here. And we can also learn what our Savior is like, because he is the great physician. He is the one that deals like a merciful physician with us. And so in God's dealings with Elijah, we see what Jesus, who is Emmanuel, God with us, is like, and the kind of merciful Savior we have. I've been trying to teach myself to ask the question of all my sermons, where is Christ here? Well, let me tell you where Christ is in 1 Kings 19. He is in the merciful Jehovah that is here ministering to his needy servant. That's where he is. So the remedies for Elijah's death wish. How did God minister to his servant? Well, the first thing he did was that he provided Elijah with rest and refreshment. He got to that juniper tree, he prayed to die, he fell asleep. Angel shakes him, bread, cold, clear water to drink, goes back to sleep again. Angel shakes him again, get up, Elijah, eat and drink. What's God doing here? He's taking into account his servant's physical frame. Sometimes our prayers to die and our discouragements simply, or at least firstly, require taking into account our need for rest and our need for food, our need to sleep, and our need to have a little downtime, like we call it in the U.S. The cure for physical and emotional exhaustion necessarily involves food and sleep, rest and refreshment. Even with the miraculous aid of God, Elijah's mortal frame could not stand one day after another of the physical and emotional strain of the day of the great assembly on Mount Carmel. If you find yourself praying to die or approaching that condition, it may be your responsibility to stop abusing your body by denying it the necessary rest and refreshment. Part of the solution may be a vacation. I think you call it a holiday. Part of the solution may be a holiday where you really get some rest, not where you recreate yourself to death or indulge in all sorts of worldliness, but actually get some rest. Secondly, another crucial remedy for Elijah's death wish is that Jehovah granted Elijah a lengthy period of time alone with himself. Here's what I think, and here's how I interpret the passage. I think that flight to the juniper tree in the wilderness, I think that's all on Elijah. I think it was sin. Okay? But the trip from the juniper tree far south into the desert to Horeb, as it's called here, the mountain of God, I think that's on God. I think that was God's idea. Well, it might have been Elijah's idea too, but I'm certain that God wanted him to take that pilgrimage to Horeb, the mountain of God. You see, there's indication in these verses that God was in favor of Elijah's 40-day trip to Mount Horeb. Didn't he say, the trip's too long for you, you need this really special bread I've made for you, you need this water for this trip? That certainly implies that God was not against it, right? The pilgrimage to Horeb was a journey to find God. You know, and sometimes there's just no substitute for lengthy times alone with God if we're going to find God. Sometimes 5 minutes in prayer isn't enough. Sometimes we need whole days in prayer. Sometimes that's what we need if we're going to be cured of the emotions, the kind of emotions that make us want to die. We need to spend much time in prayer and much time in the Word. And those 40 days alone on the pilgrimage to Horeb, Mount Sinai, the mountain of God, Elijah had a lot of time alone to seek God, and that's what he needed desperately. We must serve God, but we cannot be always giving from our souls and never feeding our souls with communion with God. Another thing that happened is this. Jehovah challenged Elijah's carnal fear. Yes. First he said, eat. And then he said, sleep. And then he said, spend time alone with me. And then God said, what? And we Americans, I think, if it had been us, would say it like this. What in the world are you doing here, Elijah? What indeed was he doing there? No good answer to that question, was there? What was he doing there? Running away from Jezebel in carnal fear. That's what he was doing there. You see, patient as we should be with people, mindful as we should be with people, of their physical frames and their need for rest and refreshment. Much as we should tell people, you've got to spend some time in prayer about that. The time comes, it must come, when we confront people with their sins, if we would be faithful in our ministry to them. And that's what happened. He slept, he ate, he walked with God for 40 days, and then God said, "What in the world are you doing here?" Because sin must ultimately be dealt with. There is no way back for Elijah in which he does not recognize his sin of carnal fear in running from Jezebel. And there's no way back for you without the confession of sin. There's no way back for your friend if they won't confess your sin. Ultimately, we must restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. That's what the Apostle Paul says, by confronting their sins. As a fourth thing that we find in this chapter, not only Jehovah challenges carnal fear, but in the fourth place, Jehovah deepened his insight into the mysteries of divine providence. He deepened his insight into the mysteries of divine providence. Elijah seems to have been very much focused on the outward. You know, God had come in fire on Mount Carmel, but then he had left that messenger of Jezebel show up at the door late that night too, right? But when he gets to Mount Horeb, what do we read? There's a wind that's tossing huge boulders around Mount Horeb, breaking them in pieces. And we're told God is not in the wind. There is an earthquake that's shattering everything around, making Elijah fear that the little cave he's in might come down around his ears. And yet we're told God's not in the earthquake. And then there's a fire. The fire of God, perhaps, at least fire sent by God, burning everything up, crackling around the outside of the cave. And we're told God is not in the fire. And then there is the sound, I'm not sure how your Bibles might translate it, of a still, small voice, or the sound of a gentle blowing. And we're told that there on Mount Horeb, that's where God was. Now, God sometimes comes, doesn't he? Sometimes comes with a rushing mighty wind. He came that way at Pentecost. Sometimes God's judgment is felt in the earthquake that divides the city into seven parts, the book of Revelation. Sometimes God is in the flaming fire that falls on Mount Carmel. But that's not the way God always works. And sometimes the things God is doing don't make the evening news. You can't hear about them on BBC. And that's what Elijah needed to know, that there were things going on in Israel that he couldn't see and didn't know about, that God was working, but perhaps not in the fire, but in the sound of a still, small voice. Elijah, whom someone has called the prophet of fire, was taught that God was not always in the fire from heaven. Sometimes he is in the soft breeze of the earth. Well, a fifth thing that God ministered to Elijah in was this. Jehovah gave Elijah specific tasks, definite jobs, to perform at a time of sorrow in our own lives. My wife shared with me something she'd been reading from a book by Elizabeth Elliot. Elizabeth Elliot was no stranger to sorrow, having lost several husbands to death. In writing to those who are in grief, Elizabeth Elliot speaks somewhere of, listen to this, the comfort of work. The comfort of work. And I think we see something of that here in 1 Kings 19, because before this chapter is over, God gives Elijah some things to do. He says to Elijah, now go back to work. Some people think, and we were talking about F.B. Meyer before the service, or as your pastor said it, Mayor. Mayer thinks this is the place where it's all over for Elijah. Elijah gets set on the shelf. That Elijah's ministry is basically over, and God's saying to Elijah here, it's over, I'm calling it quits with you, I'm just putting you on the shelf for the rest of your life. I think that's utter nonsense. I don't think that's the way to interpret the passage at all. I think that everything about the passage, as we're going to see, is against that. And one of the things that it's against that is that God isn't putting Elijah on the shelf, he's sending him back to work. He says, commission Jehu to replace Ahab and completely annihilate his dynasty in northern Israel. Commission, I want to make sure I get the name right here, Hazael as king over Aram, be king of the great enemy of the northern kingdom, to replace the one who's king now. Anoint him, anoint Jehu, and here's what else you do. Anoint Elisha, he says, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, as the one who will become prophet in your place after you're gone. And so Jehovah gave Elijah specific tasks to do. And there's a time and a place when, even after times of sorrow, grief, there's a time and a place, and sometimes I think it's before we realize it, that God is saying to us, go back to work. What you need now is to go back to work. And it's one of the great solutions at the proper time and place to sorrow, grief, and the kind of discouragement that Elijah was feeling here. There's a sixth thing that Jehovah did for Elijah. It's this. He reminded Elijah of the great truth that his purposes of salvation were sovereign. Jehovah reminded Elijah of the great truth that his purposes of salvation were sovereign. Look at 1 Kings 19:18. You see it there? I have left for myself 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. You know where that text gets picked up and quoted in the New Testament? Yes, in the great treatment of the sovereignty of God over all things and in salvation in Romans chapter 11. Paul will go on to say, even so at the present time, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. And if it's according to grace, it's not by works. Because if it's of works, it's not by grace. You see, Elijah had said, I alone am left. And God had said, no, Elijah, you don't see them. You don't know about them. You're too discouraged to notice it. But I have my elect remnant left in this kingdom. I have 7,000. I'm not even sure we should take that literally. I think it may be meant figuratively. I have a great multitude here in the northern kingdom who I have left for myself. I have left for myself. That's the way Paul takes it. Paul takes these words in 1 Kings 19:18 as emphasizing the hand of God, the providence of God, the mighty grace of God in keeping these 7,000 for himself. It's not their free will that has made them follow God. It's God's grace that has made them follow God. I have kept for myself these 7,000. They're mine. They're my elect. Which is why Paul can quote it in this vein in the New Testament. And there's nothing we need to remember more when we are discouraged like Elijah. There's nothing we need to remember more than the fact that God's purposes of grace are sovereign. That God can do anything, that he is Jehovah, and he says, is there anything too hard for me? And we need to remember that. There's a famous book entitled, When People Are Big and God Is Small. We get ourselves into that situation often, don't we? When people are so big and God is so small. When our perspective is allowing the grasshoppers of earth to hide the gigantic figure of our sovereign God. Well, Jehovah said to Elijah, stop it. Remember that my purposes of grace and my purposes for you, Elijah, are sovereign and will be accomplished. We need to hear God saying to us sometimes, I will accomplish what concerns you. And that's a great encouragement. Well, there's the seventh and last thing that God does. I'm going to have to stop preaching. I'm almost out of water. I am out of water, but I don't, no, I am almost done. Okay, so it's not a problem, Pastor Brady. I think I can make it. We'll see. Remember what one of Elijah's great problems was? What did he say? Loneliness. Loneliness. Well, Elisha is to be anointed as Elijah's eventual replacement. And we're told in the very last verses, after he had been so anointed, that he arose and followed Elijah and ministered to him. It's not good for a man to be alone. Elijah had said, I alone left. And God says to Elijah, I understand. I'm going to give you a friend and helper. You see, he'd had a servant. Little boy servant running around doing different things, helping him get the water. He'd had that kind of servant. But he'd had no friend like Elisha. He needed a friend like Elijah. Someone who would grow to become his Timothy. Grow to become eventually his replacement in Israel. He needed an Elisha, and God gave him an Elisha. I don't know how we ought to apply that to ourselves. God gave him an Elisha. Some of you may need God to give you an Elisha. And maybe one of the reasons you're hearing this message this morning is he wants you to pray that God would give you an Elisha. Maybe he wants you to realize that you already have an Elisha and you're not taking advantage of it. One of the things that marriage teaches you is how dumb you are. I had to learn this lesson. God gave me a wonderful wife with whom I could share my problems, my needs. And you know what I had the most difficult time in the world doing when I was young and a new husband? I had the worst time in the world sharing my worst problems, my worst fears, my worries, the things that were getting me down and making me moody and making me go into myself. I had the worst time sharing that with my wife. And I'm not saying I've still learned the lesson as I ought to have learned it, but the fact is, God had given me a wonderful friend to minister to me. And I was so stupid, I wasn't aware that I should use her that way. that I shouldn't keep her out of my problems. She was there to come into my problems. That my problems would seem a lot smaller if I'd actually get them out of my own brain into the clear air of day as I talked with her about them. I hope I've learned a little about that. Well, you know, God gives people wives. He gives them friends. He gives them fellow elders because it's not good for you to be alone. Well, that brings me in the fourth place. We've seen the reality, the roots, the remedies of Elijah's death wish. In the last place, and very briefly, I want you to see the rejection of Elijah's death wish. Elijah's death wish was rejected. This is one of the most wonderful examples in the entire Bible of unanswered prayer. Unanswered prayer is sometimes a wonderful blessing, isn't it? He prayed to die. God said, no, you won't die today. And God said, no, you won't die tomorrow. And God said, no, you won't die next year. In fact, God said to Elijah, I'll show you what I think of your prayer to die. Elijah, you will never die. This is the great thing about this story. Elijah, the man who prayed to die, never did. It tickles me. It's wonderful, isn't it? Elijah, the man who prayed to die, never did. No, he went up alive into heaven in a whirlwind, accompanied by chariots of fire. You say, why does that tickle you so much? Why is that so wonderful? Because it speaks so loudly to us of the triumph of God's grace in Elijah's life and the triumph of God's grace in the lives of every one of his children, doesn't it? Look it. You may be really discouraged here today. You may be really down. You may even be like Elijah, wishing you were dead. But today is not the end of the story. And that day was not the end of the story for Elijah. Just remember, if you're here this morning wishing to die, just remember this morning, if you're here this morning praying to die, just remember this morning, if you're here this morning wanting to run away, just remember this. Elijah, the man who was so down and discouraged that he prayed to die, that man never did.